Tony, great to see you.
Great to see you too. I like it.
Here we are in the Blue Lagoon. Incredible view, you know, unlike anywhere else I've seen in Bali, really. So, what's the story behind this place, and more, you know, what's your story in terms of how do you get to Bali, and you know, where do you grow up, and give us a little bit of an insight into yourself.
Yeah, well, my story to do with Bali really is, I was working in London, and I was in the 60s, you know, Beatles and Bieber and all that stuff. We were doing, and so I was in the middle of the new age in London, really. And then I was doing inflatable structures, furniture and different inflatables. And then I got invited to Australia to give some lectures. And then I got invited to lecture at different universities and things. But then when I was coming back, I decided to do the sort of hippie run from Australia back to Europe. And the hippie run included, you know, Thailand and Bali and things. So I ended up in Bali in 1970. And I liked it. And so I always wanted to come back. And so I did after a time. I managed to get back here. And it's a good place to be back. It's a good place now for me to be, because it doesn't take so much physical work. When I'm working in lots of countries, you need to have, you know, a lot of strength. My strength is not really up to it these days, because I'm taking it easier. It's more wisdom or something. That's what I know. So that's how I came to be here anyway.
Great. And you mentioned the inflatable structures, so that's something I'm quite interested in, and specifically that period, sort of 60s to 70s, it seems like there was a real kind of vision of, or a sort of like strive towards this sort of utopian type of living, and the inflatable structures seemed to be part of that, if I'm not mistaken. Like, how did you get into that?
Well, there was Archigram, do you know?
Yeah, I know Archigram, yeah.
I was really part of Archigram, not really in the center of it, but I worked very closely with them.
I didn't know that, okay.
So I've always been experimental. So I was just exploring the world in different ways, and so that's how I got into inflatables. But I ended up in Nova magazine. Do you remember that? No, you probably don't.
Maybe before my
Nova magazine was the fashion magazine sort of thing in the 60s. It was an amazing magazine, and the editor was a painter, Molly Parkin, who was a good friend of David Frost and things. I mean, there's all these links, and because everybody knew each other, you know, the Beatles and the Pink Floyd and everything. It was, so I was on the fringes. I tend to be on the fringes of things rather than the center, because I move about a lot. So maybe I'll do something in a country and do something, you know, but instead of settling down there and getting my honors from the Queen, my MBE or something, that's not important. It's sort of, and I've never been one after money particularly. I've just always trusted that somehow or other life. And it's always, I'm still here, so it must have worked so far.
It seems to have worked out, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how, you know, sometimes I had nothing, but then somebody would knock on the door and say, here's $300 I owed you from 1962 or something. You know, it's amazing, the world.
And that period in the 60s then, when you were working with Archigram, and obviously that led on to working with Buckminster Fuller, which we'll get on to, it seems, you know, there's 20 years before I was born, but it seems like it was a very special period in human history where, you know, the generation seemed to sort of be looking at future possibilities of a better world, and you had culture, as you mentioned, the Beatles, which, you know, did change the world, and you had all the kind of design and art around that. Like, what sort of created that, and what sort of do you feel was significant about that period of what we can sort of take forward into maybe today's world?
I don't know. I don't think I've ever really analyzed any of that. It was definitely a time of change, but I don't know what brought it on. It was up so many years after the war. I mean, England went through that wartime thing, and then 1951, was it? We did the exhibition and on the bank, the future of Britain or whatever it was called, and did the big dome and the Skylon and things. Actually, they were important things, but Britain had no money at that time, so it was just using up old aluminium from aircraft, I think, whatever we could build. But somehow or other, I know one of the things that happened. The schools of architecture, the people who were teaching had all come back from the war, you know. So they were sort of stuck in the old architecture. And the traditional architecture was big sheets of paper and perfect drawing and classic styles and things still, you know. And I think we felt that maybe we needed to go to somewhere new. So there was some sort of movement going on, maybe in all disciplines, that with the music and everything, that we needed to sort of bring out something new from the old. But I can't say that. That might be totally untrue. It's just
It makes sense, I guess, you know, because you were probably the first children after the war, I'd assume, or like your parents, you know, lived through that. And I guess in order to sort of like really grow, I mean, they always say creativity comes out of sort of struggle and or, you know, that's how we kind of grow. We go through struggle. And at the end of it, you then, you know, you have this sort of desire to create, versus if it's always good all of the time, people aren't quite as maybe driven to towards change, if that makes sense. I wonder if that was, obviously the war had something to do with it. And obviously it was just something in the air, the fact that there was this amazing culture and people, and there was a real kind of need for people to want to change for the better, you know? And I feel like in today's world, it seems to be sort of happening again. And I'm wondering if the pandemic has brought that on, you know, people living in an age of just constant consumerism, you know, whatever's on TV, living within this sort of physical material world. And I wonder if the pandemic sort of made us step back and think, actually, and you mentioned this earlier, looking at these sort of patterns of nature again and you know, like striving towards change. And are we sort of looking into, you know, into the sort of invisible world that you were talking about? Like, is that the sort of vision of where we could maybe head to? And could the pandemic really start that thing of us trying to reconnect again to these patterns in nature?
Yeah, I think we're going through a big change at the moment. Well, obviously we are, in the financial system and everything, and it's not really working for a lot of the people in the world, and we're a rich enough world that we should be looking after everybody. So there's definitely a big change happening, which is the pandemic forced it ahead a bit, I think. But in the 1960s, it might be just, you know, there was rationing for a long time, so we were limited on everything. And one of the things that happened in the architectural schools, because I think the architectural schools were part of the focus of the movement in a way. When Pink Floyd came from our school, the Architectural Association in London.
And I didn't know that. Okay.
And John Lennon and the people who ran the London Film School anyway, there was a lot of connections. And when you say you're from Newcastle, I remember the schools of architecture in England, the students started getting together. Mm-hmm. Before, they tend to be just, London was always the base, yeah? But the students started and visiting each other and inspiring each other, I think, in a way. There was a BASA or something, British Architectural Students Association, I think it was called. So we'd go and visit other schools and things, and so there became a sort of movement of people with new ideas, and those people would start clinging. And it happened in Europe at the same time. There was a lot of experimentation. Like the inflatables were part of that. It was happening in Europe too.
And what was the ethos behind the inflatables then? Was it the fact that they were these temporary structures that left no footprint? Was that the thing, or was it more of imagining the future of architecture? What was the sort of like idea behind the inflatables?
Well, you do a lot of work with very little material in a way, you know. So you can build quite big structures using very little weight or anything. I think that intrigued us because we could, it's a thing you can do on your own. You're not building stones and taking 50 years. You you're welding together plastic. It might kill you off with the fumes, but eat your brain away. I don't know, it was just, there was an interest in, there was new materials coming out. I remember Mylar, you know, which we accept all the time. And so we wanted to build inflatable structures with Mylar, yeah? But you can't weld Mylar, not that way. You have to use radio frequency welding and things. So we had to do a lot of experimentation to be able to use some of these materials. And Rainer Bannum was part of that movement, and the Archigram people. So we were playing a lot. I mean, we could get manufacturers to help us quite often, I think. They seemed to be able to anyway.
Yeah, because you guys were having like festivals inside them, weren't you? Was it Pink Floyd, or was it one of those, or was it Led Zeppelin, one of those bands actually played inside a inflatable structure, and something happened where it got that busy. I heard it sort of like started deflating while the band were playing, and everybody had to sort of, I don't know if you heard about that, or you involved in that.
I wasn't involved in that particular one, but I was always rather interested in inflating a large balloon in a small space full of people. So slowly this would come and sort of, you know, take over the space. So you could do things with space. And the Floyd used some inflatables sometimes, you know, they're quite famous for that. So the pop music, you know, the music movement was connected with the architecture thing. Mark Fisher was a brilliant designer who did all the Pink Floyd stuff. So there was a, you know, that connection with creative there. And the fashion business was doing the same thing, you know, was playing with new materials and things.
Yeah, I guess you mentioned there sort of doing more with less, like having one material. You could build a structure that would usually take years to build. It would take 500 different types of materials, let's say. That's quite an interesting philosophy. And that this is sort of how we've connected, because here at Space Available, we're working with the Bookmakers Fuller Institution. And they told us, yo, you've got to meet Tony in Bali, because he worked for Bucky Fuller. And then I heard about you, and you know, it's obviously amazing to get to meet you. Because you work with Bucky, I guess that was one of the key takeaways that I've learned from him, is the sort of ethos of doing more with less. And I guess the inflatables speak of that. And also the fact that it leaves no footprint. You can go and it's gone.
I don't think we were conscious of more with less at that time.
But do you think it was subconsciously part of what you were doing without realizing it? Like this sort of like notion of temporary, you know, not having to build, you know, on land and things like that. Think that was the thing of it, or was it just a cool thing?
I don't know. There was one group that were really interesting called Street Farmers. They're not very well known.
I've never heard of them.
But there were a group of students at the Architectural Association. They called themselves the Street Farmers, and they started growing food, yeah? But this is 1960s again, so it's early on. And they had ideas like putting seeds in the cracks in concrete, which would then break the concrete up and things. I mean, they were really good, and they were trying solar things and wind things. So they were sort of part of the movement that's still going on today, but they were very early on it. But there were a few other groups in Europe that were doing it too, and people connected throughout Europe. I don't know why we were connecting, but somehow we could at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. Just the aesthetic alone is amazing. And obviously the ethos behind it is, I think, very, you know, very, very important. And a kind of vision that you guys had and the way you expressed it was very unique, I feel.
I don't know. You know, these things are sort of like waves, yeah? They come in waves, and sometimes there's all this new stuff comes in, and sometimes it gets a bit dead, and then I think it's Shiva's basically destruction and creation. It's the wheel of Shiva, you know.
Yeah.
And so we go through it. We have to destroy everything before we can create, really. You have to break everything up into this atomic structure again. I think the cycles, and they tend to be global these days, probably.
And this scene that you were involved in, of architects, of designers, musicians, was there awareness around Bookmakers Fuller at that time? And when did you start working with Bookmakers Fuller, and how did that happen? How did you meet him?
Bucky was just, he really wasn't known. He'd done quite a lot of stuff, but there was only one book out on him, and it wasn't really known, but architectural design was on the cutting front of new ideas, and Monica Pidgeon was the editor there. And they started finding stuff out about Buckingham and publishing it. So he became, well, in England, we became very conscious of him because he was a new guy. I mean, he did an amazing checklist for a dwelling, you know, checking on everything you needed to do when you were designing a house or home. And of course, his geodesic stuff was important, as people really didn't know that anything about that. And then in the States, the Whole Earth Catalogue and everything came in later, yeah, and the shelter brought some things with Lloyd Kahn. So there was a lot of these things, I think, are spread between people, probably.
Yeah.
Because you go and visit the people that were doing interesting work, and then you shop ideas, and the things would develop.
Yeah. And did you... I guess the Whole Earth Catalogue was the thing that probably then propelled the whole movement on a larger scale, I assume. Because a lot of people call, I mean, even Steve Jobs said it himself, so the Whole Earth Catalogue was almost like Google before Google existed, where it had all this information, but it was in a very wholesome way, looking at whole systems, back to the land, community, shelter. But that was all, again, inspired by the teachings of Buckminster Fuller, wasn't it? With Stuart Brand.
It was very inspired by Bucky, yeah.
He sort of
Stuart Brand was, yeah. You're good. You know a lot of stuff, haven't you? You've done your...
Well, I'm very interested in like that whole period. It's something I'm very, very interested in. And that's why I was really excited to meet you and find out about your work as well.
You've been interested in it.
I feel, and as you mentioned, these waves, I feel like this is all coming back now because people are looking for this without realizing it. And I think a lot of the answers lie within some of the ideas that existed then, but they just need to be reimagined for today's world, I guess. But I feel... It was a very important period in humanity, I feel, in terms of that period that you guys were coming through and Buckminster Fuller and all of these philosophies. So I feel people are kind of looking at this again, and I think it's going to come back in quite a big way, but in a new way.
Yeah, because sometimes the tools are not there and things. So when the tools start coming, they sort of, the movement can happen. Like the flower of life and things, which everybody's wearing these days, you know, it's really a rhombic dodecahedron. But it's really quantum physics, you know, it really explains. And people don't know that particularly, but they start wearing it and seeing it. And so you become conscious of this form, which maybe later leads you into an understanding of where it comes from and how it transforms and things. So you need some of those things around, like the geodesic dome. Nobody could have a clue until you experienced a few of them, and then you realize what it was about, you know. So, and the computer, you know, thing is really, I mean, we have so much data now and information coming in, that amazing stuff that people are doing, and the unique stuff, because each individual can do creation. So that all adds to the picture all the time. It becomes very rich, our society, and ideas and things. I don't know where, I mean, you tend to get dominated by data if you're not careful.
Yeah. And if you, in the geodesic domes then, so they're very, obviously it's a big part of Bucky's work, but also it's kind of, it sort of reflects patterns in nature as well, doesn't it? And the sort of ties a lot of the universe together. Like what was sort of Bucky trying to do you feel, with this sort of exploration into geodesic domes, and like, what do you think he was trying to discover, or do you think he was just like, what do you think the main sort of takeaway was from his findings, or what you working with him, what did you feel the importance of
Bucky,
that was?
Bucky was really, you know, Bucky was rather deaf and blind, and so his senses weren't very good, so the way he went around the world was sort of feeling, in a way. You know, when he was a kid, he lived on the little island in Maine, then he'd have to row the boat to the mainland to get the mail and things, yeah. But he couldn't really see where he was so much, but he could understand from the smells and the currents and things. So he became very aware of the world in a different way, not in the physical way, but other clues. And so I think he saw the world as just energy, patterns of energy, and he decided that he should study those, find out what those patterns of energy were, and the geometry comes from that. And
wow. So it's fascinating, isn't it?
He calls it synergetic geometry because it's sort of really the geometry is at the root or the foundation of it all, not the dome. The dome is a result of just playing with the geometry, but the geometry is really a key, and we're just beginning to touch on that. And I guess, well, like, it's interesting about the virus, you know, the COVID thing. They had pictures of that virus very quickly. They could actually reconstruct it and do pictures of it and the way it was changing. But that's totally geometry. It's all geodesics, really. It's sort of, you have to be able to understand the whole structure of the thing and the relationships. And so we now have a lot more tools to play with, and some people have a mind that they can actually deal with it. You know, some people can't. I mean, I always find that we in the West are very two-dimensional in a way. We're cubic people. We understand squares and vertical and horizontal. Mm. You come to Bali and you see these beautiful baskets which are woven, but the hexagonal weave, yeah? Because it's a three-way weave. Now, if you ever try and do a three-way weave, you realize that your mind is not very good at it. It's actually very difficult for us,
yeah.
Because we think, you know, we can go like this, but to have another one coming in, where does it go? So these people who are dealing with a three-way weave are, their conceptual knowledge of that three-dimensional geometry is much better. So they can do these baskets and things. And Bucky says that a lot of that knowledge came from the seafarers in this part of the world.
Oh, really?
Because as you were, if you were in a boat, you had to really learn how to survive, and you had to look at the heavens, and you had to do a lot of work with very little material, because a boat you can't load up with, you know, stone columns to make a temple. So for the people who live on the sea, they don't leave much in the way of ruins, so we tend to ignore them.
But self-sufficient, yeah.
They're the ones that actually developed a lot of the sciences, really.
Wow.
And Bucky did a book called Tetra Scroll, which is very nice, actually. He really did it for the kids, for his daughter, or his granddaughter. It's for his daughter, that one. When he talks about, if you're in a boat and you're sailing through the sea, when you see land, the land becomes a barrier. Yeah, if you're on land and you see the sea becomes a barrier. So what the people do in the boat is they look for a river because they're still on water, and they'll go start going up the river. And so they develop those cultures, the river cultures of Asia, because they could go up the river, and they developed irrigation systems and all those great things, you know, sort of. But they were using their sea knowledge more than anything.
Well, that's incredible, isn't it? So yeah. Think about it that way. I never really thought about that.
Yeah, Bucky was very aware. I mean, he came and did the dome here in Simon's Place, you know, in Ubud. Yeah, he came to Bali more than once. He got very interested in the Pacific and the seafarers. When you're in a boat in the middle of a big ocean, you know, you've got a few challenges. And that whole thing about the Pacific Islanders listening to the waves hitting the boat so they could tell where the land was and things, you know, so they had a lot of knowledge. And I think Bucky had a lot of that knowledge. Remember, he had a boat himself. He had a yacht called Intuition, and he was very interested in the concept of intuition, you know. His intuition, he thinks, was when you learn things, or you experience things, in time you start knowing stuff because you've already been programmed so much. And so he called that intuition, really.
That's fascinating. It's almost like having that gut feeling when you know, or you feel something, and then it happens, and I guess that's probably part of sort of subconscious sort of way of knowing. It's fascinating, really.
Yeah, I mean, he was good. He has a different, because of his senses, he didn't get trapped in the stuff we get trapped in, which is a lot of it's visual.
Mm.
We're very turned on by the visual. Whereas he was looking and trying to feel the form of things and the energy flow of things. So, in a way, I don't know whether it's anything to do with the search for the Holy Grail. I have a feeling this is all part of the same.
Yeah.
The same thing. It's searching for the what drives the universe.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely had a big picture on everything, didn't he? I mean, his mission was to really kind of make the world work for the whole of humanity, and that was his life work, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, this whole thing about not working he was really onto that, yeah? He said if you've got one person who comes up with a new idea, he actually is supporting 1,000 people or something, or 10,000 people. You don't need everybody to work in a factory to do that. You've got to support his ideas. And now I think we're beginning to realize that with Elon Musk and people, you know.
I think we are, yeah. I think that's a big thing now.
He's very powerful, some of these individuals.
Mm.
And every individual probably could be in some way. But to force people to work or in an office or something is not a very good use of humans anymore.
That's interesting, isn't it? And we hear today a lot about the sort of climate crisis and climate change, and someone was sort of mentioning, well, actually, if you look at the poverty of what's happening in the world, like 1 billion people in poverty, imagine how many geniuses could be within that section of the population. So if we could try and lift people out of poverty, you might get a lot of new ideas that would actually help the whole.
Yeah,
so that might be a good way to battle climate change, because it's such a mess and a complex system, is trying to tackle that issue, something that could, that what one genius who might be within that pool of
well, it's know. Not, I mean, Becky really said everybody's born a genius, you know.
Mm.
It's just we all have different, we're all individual, unique. I mean, when he was thinking of committing suicide, yeah.
Was he?
Oh, I didn't know yet.
Oh, when he was younger?
Yeah, when he was, I don't know how old he was. He lost his daughter. And he was walking in Chicago and he was thinking of ending his life. Then he had this vision. The story goes different ways, a sort of flash of light and things. But he had this sort of vision that said to him, look, you're unique. Everybody is unique. So what you have to give is your uniqueness. You've just got to go with that and go out and give it. And that changed his heart. Then he went and just did it, you know, and trusted that whatever he was doing was what he should be doing.
Well, he really went for it, didn't he? I mean, he had a mission and he really went for it.
But I think that's true of everybody, really. I mean, any of these guys or anybody, if you get down to the heart of it, we've all got something to give.
Mm-hmm.
But we're usually driven by society in sort of weird ways to try and make a living or something.
That's it. Like you mentioned the programming. So we're all grown up, told to do this, act like this, be schooled here, and we're visual, and you just follow along. Whereas, as you said, Bucky was in a different sense because he didn't have those senses. He drilled in it, you know, he was thinking differently about things. And maybe we do somehow need to deprogram ourselves in order to know actually we are unique and there is some significant change we can make, but we just need to A, find out how you would, like, how do you discover that within yourself, and B, how do you then go about doing it within the norms of society, and how do you break out of that, you know?
Well, I mean, the reason we're in Bali probably is part of that picture, yeah?
Exactly, because that's why we're all here.
We're in search of
something.
The Balinese concept of life and living and so on is very different, so when people come to Bali, they can either stick being Western or something, or they start getting interested in some of the so-called magic or trance or something, and discovering there's more to life than just this making money or whatever it is. So it starts eating into them and they can change. So other cultures are quite useful for that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So the globalization is actually probably a very useful program or reprogramming is going on.
Yeah, well, here in Bali, they have the Trihatakarana, they call it, which is the balance of sea, land, air, and nature, and sort of living within that balanced ecosystem. It's kind of what the
three hearts of Kirana is basically humans. Whatever you do for humans. You do for the planet, and you do for the gods. I think I don't know. I've forgotten now, but
yeah,
we got some special. I don't know, we got some special thing from the government for being good at tree heater Kirana, but just, I don't know.
Right.
But it's a very important thing, because anything you look at, you have to look at those three things.
Mm.
You're supposed to. I mean, it's not necessarily followed by the Balinese all the time, but that's what you did originally.
Yeah. Sort of, obviously, Bucky's been past a few years now. Where do you think he would be heading if he was still with us? What do you think he would be? I know it's hard to say, but do you think he would now be onto something way ahead of what we could imagine? Do you think he'd be in a totally different, or is there anyone else that you feel is sort of giving an important message, such as Bucky, that's still around today? Or I don't know if there's, yeah, sort of two questions there.
I think if Bucky was still around, I hope that he'd be actually guiding us, because his ideas are right on, I think. And if we started using them regarding, you know, the educational systems and ways of living and doing more with less and everything, he actually foresaw it all. And so if he was around, I think he might be a really good guide for us, you know, people would have to follow him. I mean, he wasn't perfect. He didn't really understand the computer world. I don't think there were some things like patents and things, because he felt that the individual designer should be able to protect themselves. So you take out patents, but it doesn't really work. But he tried. He tried to find ways that would work. So is there anybody else around? Well, there's some people. It's people like Harari, yeah, who looks at the future a little bit, and he's quite good, but he doesn't really have that big vision like Bucky had.
Mm.
I think there's a lot of other people that I think we're looking at things a different way nowadays with. I like Joseph Campbell, you know, Follow Your Bliss.
Mm-hmm.
I think Joseph Campbell was looking at, it comes from the human side, looking at the way humans should go in their own lives, the hero's journey and things. That to me is sort of maybe more where it's at now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much the technical stuff. The technical stuff we can do when we decide to do it.
Yeah.
But the human feeling, the love, the soul and things is really, I think that's where we lie, really, is that to learn to love each other and learn to love the earth and realize what an amazing life it is.
Well, that's what it always seems to stem back to, doesn't it? It's kind of like, as you mentioned, the Beatles, all you need is love. And it's almost, is that the meaning? We're all searching for the meaning of life. Is love the meaning? And what does it take for us all to realize that and live in a world where we can all be prosperous, we can all, you know, we don't have to have war, you know, all these things. But it's kind of, I feel like we sort of forget that, you know,
because we're programmed. I think quite a lot of people talk about this these days, that sort of when you're born you're pretty innocent. I mean, because you haven't got the input, but you start getting the input and people start pushing things your way, or television or whatever, you know. So you start getting this input and you start fitting in with society, which you're supposed to do. I mean, that's the whole point of growing up. But the society we're fitting into is pretty outdated in a lot of ways. So we haven't got to the heart of that. How do we bring people up? Mm. I think it's really important, because if you don't follow the system, people are very negative about you, you know, sort of, because it threatens them.
Mm.
And so this thing about doing what you feel you should be doing, you don't do it because you're frightened of not fitting or something. Whereas to have trust in your own feelings is I think is really important, but it's hard because there's so much pressure on you, really, from your past and the present and the church and all sorts of things. I mean, yeah. So I try, personally, I try to do what I feel is right with me, you know,
yeah,
everything.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people are worried about, like, the notion of, like, oh, what will other people think? And yeah. And also failure. People are scared, like, oh, what happens if I fail? So they'll never actually realize their potential because of the scared of failure, you know? And then, oh, people might laugh and that generally holds a lot of people back, I feel.
Your fear is a pretty deadly thing. It's not good. Which we really shouldn't have fear because there's really nothing to fear. I mean, death is not a problem. But we think it is, in a way, and so I think it's a shame, actually. I think we've got to get rid of that fear thing. But I think to get rid of it, you have to realize that you have to show people how beautiful love is, even if it's, you know, a tiger eating a goat or something. You know, it's all part of that natural world that is okay. It's part of the game, you know.
And what sort of your opinion on this, and also when you're working with Bucky, what was his sort of sense of, like, capitalism? Do you feel that's something that would need to change, or
capitalism?
Like, capitalism as a system, do you think that's something which is holding us back, or do you think it's something we can prosper in? I know it's a big question, but I wonder did Bucky ever talk about that, like that capitalist system?
He talked about it quite a bit, and he was very conscious of it, because where does he get his money from?
Yeah.
We did a project with Bucky for the United Nations conference in Vancouver, and we hadn't got any money, but Neva Rockefeller, she was working with us because she liked Bucky's work.
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, maybe we should go and ask Daddy, you know.
Right.
And so one day I ended up in the Rockefeller house on Fifth Avenue or something, which is very funny.
That was so interesting,
really,
yeah.
Actually really odd. And I don't know whether we got a promise or what, but Bucky wouldn't take it because he felt he shouldn't take it from the Rockefellers, because he didn't agree with them, which put us in a real mess, because we had this project finished, but we couldn't get it to Vancouver. So in the end, one of our team, he was the son of the guy who owned Radio Shack, I think, and he had, you know, came from a rich family. So in the end, he just bought a trailer and got his car and just drove it across the country, you know, without Bucky's permission, really, but because Bucky could be quite difficult at times.
Right.
He had, you know, ideas. I mean, he got into trouble with a lot of people, you know, as to where ideas come from and who owned the ideas. And he was rather, he kept things to himself. He wouldn't let other people look at them. I mean, the whole geodesic calculations, the chord factors, he wouldn't let them be printed, you know. But then somebody printed them and he was really upset.
Right.
He had this, he always had a bit of confusion in him, I think, about private and public and who owned what.
Yeah.
And I think he had that because he was dependent on getting income from something, and he needed it. But his idea with the money was that every time he got income, he just spent it.
But
he wasn't interested in saving money or making money. He just felt money was a means of actually helping do things.
Yeah. Well, he was very active. I mean, God knows how many patents that he made, all his inventions and, you know, architectural structures, cars. I mean, he did a bunch of different things, didn't he? Over the years.
And the patents cost a lot.
Yeah.
And he never really used any of them, I don't think.
Yeah.
I don't think he made any money off any of them. But he felt that was the only way he knew to do things. I don't know what the solution is, you know, because in our society, if you come up with a good idea, you tend to sort of don't want anybody to know about it in a way, because you think it's worth something, so you try to hide it or hold on to it somehow. So, and the reason for that is the fear, because you want to get some income out of it to keep living.
Which makes sense. I mean, you obviously want to, you do need to, one, survive, and two, create some income so you can keep doing the work, because that was what this thing, wasn't it, of how far can you take this idea, and you do need resources to make that happen,
So the new book on Bucky talks a lot about some of his problems that he had with people.
Yeah.
Because even the people who were working with him, he often fell out with them.
Right.
They were trying to do good work, and then he'd be upset because they were doing it without his permission or something.
Mm.
So, well, the big one is Tensegrity,
Oh, Tensegrity,
Tensegrity is one of the most important discoveries in the universe, really.
And did he discover that then, Tensegrity?
Well, yeah, I mean, when you say discover, it's difficult to know.
I say discover,
One of his students came up with it. But Bucky decided it was really his, because the student had been working with him, and without him he wouldn't have come up with it.
So they
for years had a big struggle, and Bucky used to say Tensegrity was his.
Because what was the other guy called, the Tensegrity, or maybe it was an architect that came after Bucky, maybe the one that really did a lot of work with Tensegrity. Or maybe it was the guy from you're talking about, maybe.
Ken Snelson.
Ken Snelson, that's something now. Was that the guy? Yeah.
He's really an artist. He does nice work. Oh, we've got the military have come in today.
Oh, well.
Come to defend us.
Well, yeah.
It's actually very nice watching the boats here.
I know, it's beautiful. It's very peaceful up here. Thank you very much for showing us around. It's great what you're doing here, and highly recommend it. If anybody's in Bali, come check out the Blue Lagoon. So thank you very much, Tony. It's been fascinating to meet you, and
thank you, the whole team.
Really appreciate your time.